I'm very interested in the horrendousness of the modern world, which is supposed to have transcended, you know, this sort of brute force, and yet seems to return to it in a kind of recurrent way, right? Punctually every few years, there's a just grotesque amount of violence levied against one part of humanity by another. And this particular one, I have to say, this one now, from October till now in Gaza, is perhaps one of the most, you know, horrendous that we've seen, largely because the people are trapped. You know, I've actually reported from places where there's been terrible violence, but in every other place, people could run. In this case, people are just stuck there. It's like shooting pigs in a barrel, you know. It's terrible.
Hello, this is Robinson Earhart here with Pins the Podcast and the introduction to Robinson's podcast number 203. And this episode is with the historian and journalist Vijay Prashad, who did his PhD in history at the University of Chicago and was most recently the George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Vijay is a Marxist, and as such, much of his work and writing has been devoted to critiques of capitalism and colonialism. And this, for our purposes today, notably includes research on Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East more generally. This is the third installment of the second three-installment part of my two-part foray into Israel and Palestine. And in this episode, we talk about the Israel-Palestine conflict as a European problem that stems from anti-Semitism and a history of colonialism. And then we touch on various other dimensions of the issue, such as how this current war might end, Noam Chomsky's contributions to the discussion. And of note, he and Vijay have a jointly authored book coming out on Cuba this summer. They're friends and have done a lot of joint work and writing in the past. And then in this episode, we also talk about the legitimacy of Palestine, of Israel, of nations and peoples in general. And, you know, not that these discussions haven't been philosophical, but something that I really appreciate about Vijay and talking to Vijay is just how philosophically reflective he is, which I think brings a really nice perspective to these very complex issues. But next week, we shall be returning to more conventionally philosophical concerns. But I'm nonetheless, I mean, very grateful to you, Geeslings, for sticking with me as I have stepped from my lane to learn about other areas. I should also mention, though, that Vijay and I recorded this conversation before I spoke with Jeff Sachs, the guest on the last episode, number 202, which might help make sense of some otherwise seemingly anachronistic comments I made. But anyway, reviews, likes, subscribes, as you know, since I'm always saying this, they are very much appreciated. There is a Patreon, the link to which is in the description, if you would like to support the show or get nice show notes or a link to an ad-free RSS feed. But now, other than that, without any further ado, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it with Vijay. Israel and Palestine are on everyone's minds right now, but you've been researching the topic and advocating for Palestine quite a long time now. And I'm just wondering, to start us off, if your initial interest in the conflict stemmed from theoretical Marxist concerns about oppression of the lower classes, or historical interest in the area, or human rights interests, or the news cycle, or just how it all began for you?
That's a really good question. And I'm going to give you a very honest answer, which is that When I was a very young person, I regularly read the newspaper. That was just something that I did. My parents were avid takers of the newspaper. They would go through it and so on. In 1982, I was very struck by a photograph that appeared in my local newspaper in Calcutta. And that was a picture which showed two women looking through a row of bodies, trying to identify something. Now, obviously, I had no context for this. It was 1982. I was about, 15 years old. And, 15 is not a child, but nonetheless, I didn't know very much about the Middle East, let alone the city called Beirut, let alone the question of Palestine. But that picture moved me a lot. And I began to research it. And in my school newspaper, my first article was on that issue. I was about 15 and a half years old. Well, many years later, in fact, in 2014, I somehow badgered Robert Fisk. When I was living in Beirut, I badgered Robert Fisk to take me to the place where these women were looking for their loved ones. And that place was the camp of Sabra and Shatila it used to be at the edge of Beirut, but now pretty much on the road to the airport. And Robert Fisk, who was one of the first journalists inside the camp after the massacre of Sabra and Shatila, took me through there. We couldn't exactly find where this had transpired, where the bodies were laid and the Palestinian women were looking for their loved ones. But we walked around the camp. It was very moving for me. That photograph, it's remarkable. And this is a tribute to photographers. That photograph is a haunting picture. And I've used that at several occasions, to illustrate the kind of the ghostly way in which people have to live. Ghostly because in this particular situation, so many people have been killed over such a small piece of land. And this particular massacre was grotesque. The Israeli troops surrounded the camps and allowed their allies to enter and just slaughter civilians. And this moved me a lot. And I felt at that point that, my God, what kind of world do we live in where this sort of thing happens over and over again? And by the way, this opened my eyes to conflicts and this sort of behavior within India, because the very next year there was an event such as this in Assam, in India. And I remember writing about that. And then the following year, 1984, there was a terrible attack like this against the Sikh community, when 3,000 Sikhs were massacred over a weekend. So my interest in the question of Palestine isn't some sort of obsession with the question of Palestine. I'm very interested in the horrendousness of the modern world, which is supposed to have transcended, this sort of brute force, and yet seems to return to it in a kind of recurrent way, right? Every few years, there's a just grotesque amount of violence levied against one part of humanity by another. And this particular one, I have to say, this one now from October till now in Gaza is perhaps one of the most, horrendous that we've seen, largely because the people are trapped. I've actually reported from places where there's been terrible violence, but in every other place, people could run. Even during the U.S. bombing of Mosul against the Islamic State, when tens of thousands of civilians were killed. It's now forgotten that the U.S. bombing of Mosul killed tens of thousands of civilians, but most of the population could run into the countryside. In this case, people are just stuck there. It's like shooting pigs in a barrel, It's terrible.
There's a lot of stuff to get into right off the bat, but one of the first things that comes to mind is you mentioned that essentially in answering my question, you first got into the issue as a more particular case of a general human rights issue that's been going on forever and is very much still a part of the modern world. I did an episode, I think, last summer with the historian Norman Naimark here at Stanford, all about the world history of genocide. And it is amazing how it started with, predates written history, but continues up to today. And we would think that we're beyond it, but clearly we are not. But this raises another question. I mean, one of the hot button topics in the debate over Israel and Palestine today is whether or not this should be considered a genocide. And maybe we'll get to that later. But the last thing I'll say in response to what you've said is that this is novel in a sense because people are trapped, and that's what makes it so horrible. And it reminds me of something Norman Finkelstein said when we spoke recently, and he likened Gaza to a concentration camp. And that's very much in the same spirit of people being trapped and under siege. But before we go on into the specifics, granted that you got into the issue as a sort of human rights interest, I'm wondering how you viewed the conflict now on a more conceptual basis. Is it an extension of a class war primarily, or a religious war, or a colonial war, or an economic war, or all of these things? Just how you view it more broadly as a conflict?
Well, since 1982, I've had the opportunity to travel to the West Bank several times, Gaza. I lived in Beirut. I've traveled to Jordan, met Palestinians in the various camps, which are managed by the UN Palestinian Agency, or UNRWA, which has been recently defunded. I've read a lot about this conflict. I've interviewed, scholars of the conflict, people like Rashid Khalidi, Elias Khoury, who's the editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. I've spent a lot of time trying to immerse myself in this particular conflict for a number of reasons. One is that I'm very interested professionally in the question of decolonization. I've been writing about this from my PhD onwards. How do people who have been colonized extricate themselves from a colonial situation? I'm very much interested in the work of Frantz Fanon, for instance, who said in Wretched of the Earth, he slightly stretched Marxism, to take in this idea of how do the colonized, culturally, emotionally, philosophically, undertake both to understand their oppression and then to overcome it. I'm very interested in all of those themes. Palestine is, of course, one place. And as you study something more and more, as you meet more and more people, it ceases to become an arm's length scholarly interest. It becomes personal. I have friends in Gaza now. I have lost friends in the early part of the bombing by late October, early November. People who I traveled with in Gaza are now dead there. This becomes personal, and then you have a personal stake in this. I feel terribly for what's happening to the actual people that I know. My dear friend Malak Matar, who's done a beautiful painting, the Guernica of Gaza, her family is there. I talk to her and she worries about them, and go on and on. I have an author, Heather Eid, who wrote his book while the bombs were falling, and we published his book, Decolonizing the Palestinian Mind. I edited it while the bombs were falling. The preface to the book is audio voice notes, which he sent me, which I transcribed, and they become the preface to that book. The book is now out in South Africa and in India. All of this is to say, for most people who develop maybe a journalistic or scholarly interest in a part of the world, that becomes personal, because you can't have a detached attitude to people you're staying with, meeting, traveling with, right? Understanding things and so on. So now, how do I see the conflict broadly? I mean, look, it's a very complicated issue to ask a question like that, because you laid out certain frameworks. Is it this? Is it that? Is it the other? It might be many of them. I mean, at base, this conflict, if we're honest with each other, is about a European problem, which is the problem of anti-Semitism. Europe has never dealt with its real history of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism wasn't constructed in Baghdad or in Calcutta, where I was born, or indeed in Jerusalem. For millennia, Palestinian Christians, Palestinian Muslims, Palestinian Jews lived together. Anti-Semitism is a European problem, whether it starts in the Inquisition, with the reconquest of Spain by the Catholic monarchs, the expulsion of the Moors, the Muslims, the forced reconversion or the conversion of Jews to Christianity, all the way straight line to the pogroms in that band of Northern Europe from Belgium all the way out to Russia, to Tsarist Russia. A horrible, horrible treatment. And then high philosophers of Germany coming up with a debate called the Judenfrage, where they're actually debating, while they conceptualize the concept of nationalism, can Jews be Germans and Jews? You know, that Jewish question, which perplexed all these high theorists of German philosophy, you know, is outrageous. That's an offensive question. It's an anti-Semitic question itself. And rather than deal with this as a European problem, specifically as a German problem, Europe effectively expelled the so-called Jewish question, their Jewish question, to the Levant. And then you have another problem, which is that suddenly very large numbers of people come angered by what has happened to them, not in Jerusalem, not in the West Bank or none of that region, but what's happened to them in Europe. And they come in order to claim land to build themselves a safe haven. But that safe haven meant the expulsion of 750,000 Palestinians, whose numbers now are about 5 million, you know, when you take into account the descendants and so on. So what becomes a horrendous, tragic, ugly outcome of European anti-Semitism ends up creating a new problem, which is a problem effectively of a settler class that emerges, expels people from their lands, and creates an ethno-nationalist state, which is, in fact, strangely enough, drawing from European conceptions of nationalism. You know, one language, Hebrew, one blood, one people, and so on, ein Volk. All of these are European ideas. In Asia, ideas of nationalism weren't premised on mono-national nationalism. You know, they were mostly multinational nations that developed in many parts of Asia. India is a good exemplary test because India, formed in 1947, the year before Israel, is a multinational nation. I'm not saying it was born in peace. 1 million people died as a consequence of the partition of India. It was ugly, but it wasn't created as a one nation, one people, one language. That's what the far right is trying to do now in India, but that's not what it was. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is this entire displacement of the Palestinians at a time, 1948, at a time when decolonization was starting for much of the Third World, puts on the table a new people who had lost their homeland, you know, where their national aspirations were being cast aside. In fact, their identity was being challenged. There is no such thing as a Palestinian, says Golda Meir, and so on. So at that point, this suddenly becomes a struggle for national liberation. It's not a class question. It's not any of the other things. It's plain and simple, a struggle for national liberation. So you have two competing, in a way, nations in struggle here. One of them a victim of European anti-Semitism, and the other, the victim of the victims of European anti-Semitism. You can see where I'm coming from, which is to say, this is Europe's problem. And today, Europe is sanctimoniously standing beside Israel as it pummels the Palestinians, almost wanting to finish the European problem, which it set in motion with Lord Balfour's declaration in 1917.
That was an absolutely beautiful framing of the problem. So I really appreciate it. And framing this as a problem of European anti-Semitism is surprisingly not something I've heard in the conversations that I've had about this on the show. And when I reflect on that, I think it's largely because most contemporary analyses of the situation neglect the more proximate European history in favor either of ancient history or the post-1948 Middle East, and they forget what might have been happening in the 200 years before 1948. But I'd like to return to what you said about colonialism, because that's a very big issue in today's discourse, and I know you've done so much thinking about it. But the region, of course, is no stranger to invading powers with the Ottoman Empire, the Roman Empire, more recently, the British Empire. But one of these historically minded assessments of the situation is that the region historically belonged to the Jews and they are simply returning there, under which analysis it does not really seem appropriate to think of this or conceive of it as a colonial enterprise. So I'm wondering how it is that you see the situation to justify thinking of it in this way.
Yeah, this is an interesting problem because in a way it's a first mover problem, you know, and it begs the whole question of indigeneity. You know, who has the right to what? Imagine right now if a group of people from the U.S. East Coast who have ancestry in the U.K. just decide to fly into London Airport and to squat somewhere in, I don't know, in Yorkshire and say that I've come back, this is my ancestral land, I want it back. Do you think that's going to go down very well? You know, or consequently, if native peoples show up in New York City and say, hey, you know, this is our land, so we are now claiming everything from Central Park down to the edge of the island because this used to be my ancestral area, you know, hunting grounds and burial grounds. I mean, they would all be shot, okay? So we have to be cautious about a bill or rather a document, you know, land deed given by ancient history. We have to be very careful about that because if that's going to apply to Palestine, it should apply to other places, you know, and we get into trouble. Yeah, because this opens a really interesting premise because why should it only apply to Palestine? Why shouldn't it apply to other places? You know, I should have the right then to show up in northern, you know, Pakistan now and claim some part of territory where I've never been. You know, I have some ancestral memory that we come from some villages over there. We have no idea what that was. So I would caution against that principle because I think that principle is not sustainable, you know, for the planet as a principle. Now, there is nothing inappropriate about people saying, look, we want to live in that area. After all, even in 1948, there were a number of Palestinian Jews who lived there prior to the migrations from Europe. There were a number of Palestinian Jews. They lived there quite happily. You know, I visited Jerusalem, walked around there, the Armenian Quarter. There are families that date back to such a long time ago. Jewish families as well date back to such a long time ago. You know, and there's no issue about their presence there. You know, the question becomes when, you know, people from the United States whose families hail from Lithuania move back who don't go back to Lithuania to claim their lands in Lithuania or in Ukraine, but go to this place where there is some ancient claim, not even a proximate ancestral claim. You see, let's do the cutoff, okay? 300 years. 300 years ago, your family was in Ukraine. You can go back to Ukraine and claim some land there. But the claim to, you know, the Holy Land, as it's called, is crazy because you can't actually prove that your family had rights there. Because by what basis? You see, under capitalist system, we have the idea of property rights. But there has to be some measure of asserting property. You can't assert property as a nation. We assert property, individual property rights. So now the second problem, the first problem was it opens a really bad, it sets a bad precedent. The second problem is we've changed the idea of property rights suddenly to apply for the Jewish people. It is a corporatist idea of property, not an individual idea of property. See, I can go to a house and say, hey, listen, this used to be my house. I was expelled from it. So now I make a claim because this was this house on this road, this very house was my family house. Here's a photograph, right? Jewish families who go to the Swiss bank and say, that painting you have in the vault, I have a photograph of it. Here's my grandfather. Here's that painting. It was taken by the Nazis, put into your vault. I claim it. But I claim it because it's my individual or familial inheritance. I can't claim something in a corporatist way. Like all of this property is for all of the people of Jewish ancestry around the world. Do you understand? This is a different understanding of property rights. And okay, let's open this precedent up now. Let's accept that we have this collective property claim that can be made. Where does this end? You know, I understand that most national liberation claims, the Kurdish people claiming a Kurdish homeland, is to some extent a collective property claim. All nationalisms, to some extent, are collective property claims. But in most cases, they are collective property claims of people who already live there. You know, they are just saying, we want to have sovereign right to rule ourselves. Not that we are all coming, all of us, to come to that place to take it over and expel you from it. I mean, we'll get into all kinds of complexities here, you know, if we get into all that. You know, this change of the idea of what is property rights. This is not exactly under the laws of capital, if we're quite honest with each other, these collective claims. So I would hesitate to say that, hey, listen, God gave you a deed to all of this, and therefore you have a right to it. Because when we start doing the God gave you a deed, God gave lots of people deeds to lots of things, you know. And I'm not comfortable with God's deeds, because tomorrow I can sit down somewhere. Oh, why am I giving you a hypothetical? I used to live in a flat in Green Park, which is in New Delhi. I could see the main road, Aurobindo Marg, right in front of me. One day, on Aurobindo Marg, near a little park, somebody placed, or I don't know who placed, a little statue of a god, okay? That was placed there. Nobody said a thing about it. This is a common thing in India. Then somebody showed up, this guy showed up, very clever guy, and he built a little house, tiny little house, to encase the statue, to keep it free of the rain. Then he built himself a little shelter as the keeper of that statue. People started to come and give offerings to it. Now, if you go there, it's a big temple. In other words, this statue was an instrument of a very smart land grab. And the temple now has a dormitory where this guy, who still has, he's built himself a nice little house, rents out rooms to people. Okay, they've taken part of the park. The municipality doesn't know how to expel them because of it's a religious thing. So claims on land based on religion are dangerous. And I would not like to see this become a natural, common, you know, thing, because I can have a vision tomorrow and claim something in the name of God. And if I develop followers and they get arms, dangerous things happen. Okay? I mean, so we need to be careful about that. If the Bible or the Torah says this land is yours, but somebody else says this land is ours, you're going to have a big clash. And why am I being hypothetical? Let's consider the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Temple Mount share real estate. And there are curricula for young children in Israel who are taught. They're asked questions in their school, the religious schools. Should we knock down the Al-Aqsa Mosque? And children say, yes. Should we build the second temple there? Yes. I mean, that is insane. You know, I'm not saying that you can't have, you know, differences of opinion about various things. But, you know, we're now talking about deeds from God, real estate claims over different competing religious, you know, traditions and so on. I just saw this in India where, you know, in 1992, a mosque was knocked down. A 16th century mosque was knocked down. And now a Hindu temple has been built on that very spot. Is that a good thing? I think it's appalling. I think there's got to be space for different religions to share land and not make these claims in order to humiliate each other, you know? I mean, how do you know that where that mosque is exactly where the god Ram was born, and therefore the temple has to be built right on that? How do you know that? You don't even know Ram's birthday. I mean, how do you know that that's exactly where the Torah says the second temple should be built, you know, or that that is in fact, you know, despite the fact that the wall of the temple is there, that it should be built in this direction and can't be built over there. You know, if you've ever been to Jerusalem, you'll know that there's Al-Aqsa over here. There's the Temple Mount here, but there's a plaza. Build the second temple on that plaza if you need to. Why do you have to say, let's knock down the temple? And that overlapping claim is precisely what maintains these conflicts over and over again, saying that, for instance, God gave us the deed to this, therefore people who used to live here have to be expelled. That's an overlapping claim on territory. Why not learn to live side by side? Isn't that also possible?
Again, that was really just terrific. I mean, you've raised some serious objections to two of the primary Zionist arguments. So a deed from God, as you put it, which I'll agree is not compelling. And then the issue of historical right, which raises many questions about property rights, some of which, I mean, if answered in Israel's favor, would really shake up the distribution of land across the world. And then I think the third main Zionist argument centers around the need that seems to come out of events like the Holocaust and those hundreds of years before that in Europe. But as you point out, that's very much a European problem. But before we talk about a solution, which you just brought onto the table, I'd like to return to an inflammatory issue that you mentioned earlier, which is whether or not there is such a thing as a Palestinian. And I think this is resonant with the discussion we had about, or what you were saying about indigeneity. But on the pro-Israel side, I have quite recently Noah Tishby in mind, whose book Israel, I think it's called Israel, A Guide to the Most Misunderstood Country on Earth, but I might be wrong. She questions the historical existence of a Palestinian people and claims that you cannot trace them back to any of the tribes that were extant around the historical times when Israel was there. And then, of course, there are continuing arguments and debates over whether or not Palestine was empty or just sparsely populated before 1948, which is very difficult for me to weigh in on or form opinions about just as a non-historian, because you can have two very prominent historians. So I have Benny Morris in mind. I have Norman Finkelstein in mind, where they're both citing sources apparently doing very rigorous investigations and coming to completely opposite conclusions about whether or not Palestine was in fact heavily populated and the land was being used before the Zionist movement went underway. But let me ask you how you think about Palestinians as a people and what substantiates their claim to the land, given what we were just discussing about property rights?
Well, let's start with, I think, two pretty incontestable facts. Maybe people will contest even these. I think it's pretty incontestable that 750,000 Palestinians were expelled in 1948 from their homes, what Constantine Zurayk, the Lebanese historian, called the Nakba, or the catastrophe. I don't know if anybody contests that 750,000 people were expelled from their homes. That's one number. Let's assume that that's a number that everybody accepts, okay? Now, second, I think it's pretty widely acknowledged. If you look at the Israel state's documentation, it's pretty well acknowledged that when the state of Israel was established in 1948, the Jewish population in the state was 630,000 people. So 750,000 people expelled, and the Jewish population in 1948 was 630,000 people. I think that's except these two facts are correct, which I think is understood to be true, but we're in an interesting starting point, because the Jewish population then, after the expulsion, is about 120,000 less than the people expelled. So it's not a huge number of people at that time. If you look at the population now, in the millions, it is pretty clear that both the Jewish and Palestinian populations could have lived together. Excuse me. could have lived together. There was enough room for both to live there, to build a project that was genuinely secular and not an ethno-religious state. You'll remember that the founders of Israel were in fact not keen to use Israel to found a Jewish state, you know, which is the name of the book by Theodor Herzl. Many of them were quite secular in their own orientation. Sorry. And they didn't want to found a Jewish state per se. That's why there's an ambiguity in Israel, you know, and that's why there continues to be a fight between, on the one side, the more religious sections and some of the secular sections, you know, about what family law should be and so on. If it were strictly a Jewish state, then Jewish law would prevail and there wouldn't be space for, you know, secular sorts of discussions. Okay. So demographically, it's not that there's no room there at that time in 1948. You cleared out 750,000 and you have a population 630,000. Okay. Now, let's go back. Who was cleared out? Who were they? There is a sentiment says, well, they were just Arabs and they were cleared out. So let's just assume they were generic Arabs. Let's leave it at that. Still, 750,000 people and their children have, through a UN resolution, 194, resolution 195, the right to return to their homes. That is enshrined in international law. So whatever you want to call them, they have a right to return to their homes or return to their territory. May not be to the exact home, because remember, it doesn't specify in the resolution. They have a right to return. Does it say right to return to their own home? It's not actually very precise. But whatever you call them, they have a right to return. So why are you denying? I'm now talking to those who are opposed to this discussion going in this direction. Why are you denying international law? You're not permitting the people who are expelled. I don't think anybody doubts the expulsion. Why aren't you denying the right to return? Okay, so that's one. That's got nothing to do with whether they are Palestinian or not. Okay, that's the basis of Resolution 194, a United Nations resolution. It has the status of international law, and it specifically says those 750,000 people have a right to return, whatever you call them. And that has not been obliged. So in that way, Israel is already in violation of international law, full stop. Secondly, what does it matter what they call themselves? I mean, what does it matter? You know, let's say they call themselves Philistine. Going back and saying that nothing like Philistine existed is now a debate of the ancient world. And it's a debate which I've already said is not the best place to have this conversation, right? We go back to the ancient world. My God, what are you starting in terms of precedence? You know, I mean, all European descendants should leave the United States and Canada, you know, and Mexico and everywhere in South America. All of you should go home because you don't have a right to this land. I mean, this historical precedence argument, how far back do you go? You know, so the debate about, oh, there's no such thing called Palestinian, going back to the ancient world, that the names of the tribes and so on, to my mind is specious. Because that's only an important discussion if you want to have a debate about, you know, 79 AD or whatever, right? If we're going to go back all the way. But that opens a very serious problem. And again, that's the earlier problem we talked about. When do you start these discussions about who belongs where and who's entitled to what? Let's just go back to the 19th century. Well, in the 19th century, there were people who called themselves Palestinians. And we have lots of evidence. In fact, even the Balfour Declaration uses the word Palestine. British maps say Palestine. The Ottomans called it Palestine. You know, so at some point in human history, Palestine comes into existence. It is now in existence. So the debate about the historical necessity of the palace is ridiculous. I mean, let me ask you a question. There's no evidence of the United States of America before 1776, right? I've never seen the word United States of America used before 1776. The term American is a specious term. Amerigo Vespucci didn't exist in prehistory or even in early history. So that means people should stop calling themselves Americans, and there should no longer be something called the United States of America. There's no Mexico, okay? I mean, this argument is ridiculous. There's an element of it. Now, interestingly, this argument is not ridiculous if you remain within the tunnel of the debate around Palestine and Israel. Inside the narrow tunnel of this debate, these debates and arguments seem real, if you understand what I mean. They've taken on the status of serious issues. In my opinion, once you comparativize these debates, they are ridiculous, as I've just shown you. This is a ridiculous issue. To debate whether Palestine is real is super dumb. Because then you could say, for instance, forget the United States. That's an easy one, right? That's a really easy one because it has such a recent history. But let's take much earlier places. Let's take China. You know, China is a recent phenomenon. China was created by the national liberation struggle against the Japanese and against the Kuomintang. It was in that long struggle from the 1920s onward that modern China was built. You know, territorial China was established. You could make claims to the past. Modern India. There was no modern India before the freedom struggle. The freedom struggle unites British territories with the old princely states and draws the boundary of India. India is a modern construction. Germany is, for God's sake, a modern construction. It was brought together by Otto von Bismarck. Germany, before that, was a bunch of disparate principalities and baronies and all kinds of odd feudal ducks. Okay? It doesn't exist before the 1870s. So this particular debate can only be entertained if the rest of the world vanishes and we only talk about the so-called Israel-Palestine dispute. If you take it out of the narrow, suffocating sewer in which these disputes take place, bring it into the bright sunshine of the whole world, right? These are ridiculous discussions. I mean, for somebody, a grown person with a brain who has read any kind of logical system, you don't have to take formal logic for this, okay? You just have to have some basic intelligence. We'll understand that to say that the people don't exist when they say we exist is ridiculous. You know, they say we exist, you say no, you don't exist. That is at the level of a Monty Python debate. That is not serious, you know?
Well, since we only have so much time left, one thing I do want to make sure that we get to discuss, because it surprisingly hasn't come up in some of the other discussions I've had, is a solution to the issue, which you already gestured at earlier. And this might be a good time to mention your friendship, your long-running friendship with Noam Chomsky, because one, I'm wondering how you think that this situation ought to be or will be, and maybe these are two different answers, resolved, but also how your views might relate to or differ from Noam's, just because I know that he has also been very vocal on this issue over the years.
I mean, first, we are different people. We come from different generations. Noam's a man who comes deeply out of the Jewish tradition. You know, he is very well schooled in Jewish history, in Jewish faith, and so on. He was raised in a household where these things were important. He has a direct link to European anti-Semitism. He knows what it did to parts of his family, and so on. When he was a young man, he went and lived in the very young Israel. You know, he lived in a kibbutz, and so on. All of that marks his own understanding of how he sees Israel. But I must say, a couple of things. One, there is no daylight between Noam and I when it comes to a condemnation of the behavior of the Israeli state. There is no difference of opinion. Noam is a fierce critic of the oppression and of the occupation of the Palestinian people. And I don't think there's any daylight between us. There may be some tactical differences, but that doesn't matter. You know, Noam may be uncomfortable with certain language like boycott. That's because of his own history. You know, maybe discomfort with some of the language. But there is no daylight in his commitment to seeing the people, both peoples, have a just solution in this. Okay? And I also agree with that. I don't have a disagreement. I don't think there is going to be a situation ever where there's going to be a mass exodus of Israeli citizens out of the region. That's crazy. Nobody is even talking about it. It's a complete misunderstanding of the slogan, from the river to the sea. Let me explain that a little bit. You see, what it refers to is the Jordan River, which is the barrier between Israel, the West Bank, Jerusalem, and Jordan. The Jordan River runs effectively from Syria, from the border with Syria, all the way down to the Dead Sea. And the sea, which is the Mediterranean, that defines this region in a way. Over the course of the period from 1948, one Israeli government after the other has tried to raise the costs of living between the river and the sea, tried to adversely lift the cost of living there for Palestinians, made it harder and harder. Right from 1948, you know, Elias Khoury says that there wasn't just one Nakba in 1948, there's a permanent Nakba, constant attempt to get people to leave. And we've seen that. There's policy, you know, there's statements. When Ariel Sharon was the Minister of Agriculture, he put in place the settlement policy to effectively raise the price of living in the West Bank and so on. Okay, so we know that there is an idea within Israeli ruling circles to either expel Palestinians from this territory, from the river to the sea, and build a singularly Jewish state, or if Palestinians remain, they have to remain as subordinate. That's why international bodies consider it an apartheid situation. Okay, so from the river to the sea is actually official Israeli ruling class policy. That's not a fantasy. That's the policy. You know, greater Israel. That's the policy. It's there in the Likud statements. It's there now when government officials talk about the Gaza Nakba or the second Nakba. That's what they're saying. From the river to the sea, this will be a Jewish state. So that's one view of the Jewish, you know, state from the perspective of this ruling class inside Israel, including Benjamin Netanyahu, but not exclusively his vision. It's widely shared by lots of people, including by Mr. Galant, who claims to be his opponent and is sitting now in the war cabinet. Yoav Galant, the defense minister. Okay. And Benny Gantz as well. You know, the guy who's come into the war cabinet as the opposition also shares this sort of opinion. From the river to the sea, we'll build some kind of Jewish state. Okay. Now, that's one vision. That's a vision which is annihilationist. Get rid of the Palestinians. When Palestinians now use that slogan, what they mean, I feel, is from the river to the sea, let us create a place of equal rights where Israelis and Palestinians can create some one, this is the one state solution, but not a one state which is a Jewish state, but a one state which is a democratic secular state. That's another vision. Now, I can't and you can't establish what should be the victor in this. You know, Marx writes in Capital, when two equal rights contest, force prevails, Marx writes. You know, and here there is a strong belief amongst the Jewish ruling circles in Israel that they must build a Jewish state. You know, they see themselves as a Jewish ruling circle, not an Israeli ruling circle, that a Jewish state must be built. That's one right. You know, it's a right. They see that as their right, given by God or whatever. That's a right. And the other is suggesting, no, no, we need a secular democratic project, partly because the two-state solution has been vitiated by the settlement policy, the walls, the Gaza expulsions, and so on. You can't really have it. Where are you going to build the two-state? Okay, two-state solution had as one of its axioms building a transportation network between Gaza and the West Bank, and that people in both sides could freely move to each other. This was never put in place. The day after Oslo was signed, this was set aside. So the two-state solution never really been taken seriously. you're going to end up with some kind of one-state solution, okay? That's what's going to happen. Either it's an exclusionist, apartheid, Jewish state, or it's going to be a secular democratic state where everybody has equal rights. This second one is going to be very hard to put into play. And the reason it's going to be hard to put into play is that there is this doubleness inside the Israel project, which is that, you know, Ben-Gurion and others didn't want to establish a Jewish state. They wanted to create this sort of non-Jewish state, but keep the Jewish state thing going. This form of, let's call it duplicity, maybe, or lack of, you know, trying to shut the door on this conversation. Whatever your opinion on it, they didn't decide one way or the other. But increasingly, at least since the 1970s, the opinion has grown that it should be a Jewish state, that if you allow Palestinians full rights, this is going to dilute the Jewish character of the state. And that is seen by certain people in Israel as itself a kind of annihilation. So now you have two annihilationist problems to deal with, right? And this is going to be hard. So we can't solve this. You can't create a philosophical solution to a real problem like this. But we can see all the paths logically forward. The annihilationist approach of building a Jewish state is terrible because this is going to mean really, you know, millions of people displaced. And it's going to put off but not suspend the struggle of the Palestinians for emancipation. It's not going to end it. You're going to move 2 million people from Gaza into Sinai. They are going to continue to contest, want their land back and so on. It's not going to end anything. So really building a Jewish state is not a final protection unless you kill millions of Palestinians. On the other side, building a one state, which is secular and democratic, is going to worry certain people saying, well, what about the Jewish character of the state? Now, we may need to have a discussion saying, do you need to establish a religious character to a modern state? This is a good question. It's a question we should ask Saudi Arabia. It's a question we should ask other countries that have a religious character to the state. Personally, I don't believe that modern states should have a religious character. I think that they should have protections for people to, you know, worship and so on, but the state shouldn't have a religious character. The morality of a state has to be founded through the practice of citizenship, not through ancient texts. But that's a big debate and dispute. Look at the United States going directly in the opposite direction. You know, maybe within the next 4 years, some president is going to establish that there's a state religion in the United States and it's Southern Baptist, you know, faith or whatever. That you could practice other things, but Southern Baptists are given special privileges. It's already moving in that direction. I don't like this direction. So I would hope that in a place like Palestine, this doesn't become the way forward. And by the way, it only exacerbates differences. You know, when religion is put on as the marker, and you say this is a Jewish state, it's going to create an Islamic backlash to it, you know, which is not a secular democratic protest for liberation. And that's exactly what happened with the creation of Hamas in 1987. Hamas mirrored the rise of Likud from 1977. These two formations mirror each other. And it's not good for the region, in fact. This tendency to move towards a more eschatological politics rather than a politics of secular democracy.
Well, while I totally agree with you about the problems with what you call the annihilationist solution, so namely that it will not end the conflict without the deaths of millions of Palestinians, the other one-state solution that involves a secular merging with equal rights for Israel and Palestine, it reminds me of this quote from E.O. Wilson, the Harvard late Harvard Myrmecologist, who on communism said something to the effect of great idea, wrong species, with the idea that ants are great communists, but perhaps humans would not make them. The connection here being that, sure, it would be wonderful if these two groups of people could merge and form this secular society, but it just seems so impossibly contrary to human nature that people with such totally intractable differences could ever live harmoniously together.
I never thought I would start a discussion about Wilson, E.O. Wilson, who has a very controversial legacy himself. Some people have accused him of eugenics and racism. So, well, you know, it's worth considering this. And the reason I say that is because that's an interesting, it's a witty observation. It has all the wit of the high table at Cambridge, you know, great idea, wrong species, very rum expression. On the other hand, what does he mean by species, you know, and is our species being given and therefore stable and unchanging? I mean, look, for God's sake, and I mean for God's sake, most people around the world have learned to live with people who are very different in their ways, their orientations, their belief systems, and so on. I mean, people have made enormous strides in building tolerance. You know, let's just take the case of sexuality. I mean, look at the immense advances made by human beings in coming to terms with the fact that everybody doesn't share the same form of sexual pleasure and familial orientation. People want to build different kinds of families, you know. Now, I know the literature. People say, well, in the early modern period, there was more tolerance. Maybe there was. History goes in zigs and zags. But certainly, if you take just the United States in the 1950s, there was no tolerance. In Britain, for instance, homosexuality was banned. Now it's not banned. Now it's, in fact, you'll have the mayor of London leading the Pride March. Our species has the capacity to evolve and to learn and to develop and to some extent become better, not always. History moves in zigs and zags, not in a straight line. But I reject completely the second part of that statement, you know, which is, you know, great idea, wrong species. What species are you talking about, Wilson? Because the species isn't given, you know, the species evolves. Our species being is quite remarkable. It's able to change. It's able to feel horror about things which only 50, 60 years ago were seen as quite natural. I follow things in different parts of the world, and I marvel every time there's a school shooting in the United States. It doesn't provoke the Japanese people to say, yes, we are humans, let's all arm up. They are like horrified, saying, what's happening in the US? That means that our species is not singular. Our species is capable of learning. Our species, you know, understands information, data, processes it, comes up with new solutions. Now, we can say that people also zigzag a little too much. There's a little too much zag, not enough zig. When I was younger, we used to all say, hey, listen, our generation is the first generation that's going to be non-sexist. You know, we are going to create households where we'll all cook equitably. Of course, it doesn't turn out exactly like that. But my God, for God's sake, it's so much better that we had those discussions then than, let's say, our parents who never talked about it. And now, you know, as with people my generation with their children are in a way different than their parents were. You know, when their children come and say, hey, you know, that's a sexist remark. Even some of my more, zigzagged sexist friends had that zig in an earlier period and they understand the vocabulary. They don't look at their children going, what are you talking about? You know, the species alters, the species learns. We have so many examples of people who had been adversaries learning to live with each other, becoming even allies. I mean, look at France and Germany. Right through the history before the 1950s, those countries were perennially at war, you know, or France and Britain. You just need to read Shakespeare to learn that. You don't even have to take a history class. One war after the other, once more into the breach, he says. And now, you know, they are basically living together in some amity, collaborating with each other. So I don't accept that because I reject the idea that people are fixed. I believe very much in the idea that people, given the opportunity, will allow their best natures to bloom. And really, isn't that why we have politics and we try to make the world a better place? Because we have some faith in the capacity for people to be their better selves.
Well, I think that was a tremendously uplifting response to E.O. Wilson. And I like the idea of ending with this notion that people have made enormous strides in living together. But because I would love to keep you for another few more minutes, I would just like to ask, though, certainly you've given some great examples of people coming to live together and us making great strides toward that. But how then practically, given that you've already said that this is the much more difficult outcome to achieve than the annihilationist one, how practically do you see this happening?
It's not practical. And that's the point, right? I mean, human change, human transformation is just not practical. These are leaps into the dark, you know. When, for instance, the Soviet Revolution took place, it was a leap into the dark. You know, ordinary people, peasants, workers, people who had not had 5, 8, 10, 15 generations of a certain kind of, you know, of learning and a certain kind of bourgeois culture were now in charge. It was a leap into the dark, you know, to have, you know, the son of a domestic worker as the minister of high office. You know, it was a leap in the dark. Look, the United States, when there was an attempt over the course of the 20th century to eradicate the immense and ugly burden of racial hierarchies, racism, you know, Jim Crow and so on, it's a leap into the dark. You know, it was a struggle. People fought hard and died in the United States to establish the equality of peoples. It wasn't easy. It was ugly. And people have died even till now trying to establish equality. Now, they were not fighting politically. They were just walking down the street, were shot by somebody, police officer or a vigilante or whatever. But every one of those incidents brings people onto the street and schools us in the limitations of our advances and so on. So there is no ease of this. There is nothing practical. It is extraordinary how humans make these changes. That's why I like that idea of the zigs and the zags. You know, we make an advance, then we lose a little, and then we keep going. You know, the human spirit is pretty eternal, and our examples keep going. I mean, after Medgar Evers was killed, why didn't black families in the United States say no more children can go and protest or even go outside? You know, you're not going to go and you can't have a white friend. No, millions of young people went out to continue the protest. Millions of young people went and socialized with their white friends. You know, I mean, the families didn't say the example of Medgar Evers is retreat. They said the example of Medgar Evers, who was brutally killed, is to go forward. You know, the assassination of King, it wasn't to produce a retreat. It certainly did break down the movements a little, but it also inspired people to keep going. So, yeah, there is nothing practical in this. There is merely this insanity that we have. You know, I mean, you understand philosophy. You understand what it means. If I say there's an imperative, you know, the human spirit has certain imperatives. One of them is a fight for liberty of some kind or freedom. These are imperatives. You know, human beings, like other species, do not take being caged in lightly. You know, even when you go to the zoo, those animals haven't fully surrendered. They're always looking for a way out. You know, and humans are like that. It may take us a long time to understand how to break out of the zoo, but we break out. You know, it from the very beginning of the enslavement of humans in the transatlantic slave trade, people were fighting for freedom. It took a long time to get good strategies down and to change, you know, opinions of other peoples and so on. But people kept fighting, you know, including those people from West Africa who, when they were chained, were walking off the slave ship in the Carolinas, turned around as if in one, and the whole line of people walked back into the ocean and drowned themselves. That was an immense form of resistance, an immense statement saying, I would rather walk back to Africa under the ocean than submit to the horrors of your plantations. But the people who did that, they wouldn't have known that hundreds of years later, there would be a monument, you know, to people like them and there would be some victories, which are still not complete, but are a long way away from people in chains being made to work for free on plantations, you know? So these are leaps into the dark. So when one says, oh, how can you even imagine Palestinians and Israelis living together? I would say, how could they have imagined 400 years ago that people of African and European descent would live side by side in some god-awful suburb in Central California? And they do.
Well, Vijay, it has been so wonderful to meet you. I tremendously appreciate your thoughtfulness and your wide base of knowledge, and I am already so much looking forward to the next round.